Welcome to Anthony Plogon Music. When Tony and I first started the podcast, our main focus was going to be digging deep into what it takes to become a world-class musician. But over the course of time, we started interviewing a broader range of guests, such as Hamido Fujita on the potential and ever-evolving impact of AI on the music industry, Anne Majette on the perspective of a top-level music critic, and Jan Swafford, an exceptional author who's written several composer biographies. In short, we wanted to expand our discussions to explore a bigger variety of life in the world of music. And since Tony and I currently use Steinberg's Dorico for our engraving work, it only made sense to ask somebody at the heart of the notation software development scene what kind of thinking and work go into making a high-level engraving system. Meet Daniel Spreadbury, the product marketing manager for the Dorico Music Notation System. After Daniel graduated from Oxford, he worked at Sibelius for around 12 and a half years. When he and the team were let go by Avid, most of them were then hired by Steinberg, where they began the development of Dorico. In part one of this conversation, Daniel talks about his beginnings in music and technology, his love for literature, and how those passions all merged together, eventually leading him to work at Sibelius. At the end of part one, Daniel sums up the transition from Sibelius to Dorico. And just to be transparent, Dorico has graciously sponsored several of our podcast episodes, including this one, but this interview isn't meant to be a Dorico plug. It's about learning how someone like Daniel can fuse their love and expertise in music with other skills they're deeply passionate about. And it's also about taking a small peek behind the curtain of the evolving music notation software scene and seeing a slice of its fascinating history.
Create music that moves with Dorico 5, the brand new version of the music notation and composition software from Steinberg. Packed with new features throughout the application, it's the perfect time to update from your current version or to try Dorico for the first time. You can start for free with Dorico SE or Dorico for iPad, which now allow projects with up to 8 players. Or step up to Dorico Elements, which now allows projects of unlimited size and features an expanded engrave mode. For professional use, choose Dorico Pro, which has many unique features you won't find in any other software. Visit www.steinberg.net/Dorico today and make more time for music.
Daniel Spreadbury, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me, Tony.
And Eddie Ludema, thank you for joining us as the tech guru for the podcast.
The tech guru. It's fun to be here. Thanks, Tony.
Okay. Well, let's start at the beginning, if you don't mind. And Daniel, could you tell me how you got into music and tech and which came first?
Oh, that's a good question. Which did come first? I mean, basically, I've been interested in them both as long as I can remember. I'm of an age where, so I'm 46 now. So when I was about 4 years old, that was the first time that we had a computer in the house. I've got an older brother. I'm one of five. I'm the middle child of five children. And my elder brother, he is nearly 10 years older than me. So he was already a very, very smart man, my older brother, a brilliant mathematician, physicist, and he's worked in computers his whole career. So when he was a teenager, Dad bought him an early home computer, which was a Commodore PET, very, very primitive thing, in about 1980. And I remember using that when I was about 4 years old. And my mother always said that, you know, I was singing before I was talking. So I think they both came hand in hand, really. Just really, as long as I can remember, I've been singing. I'm a lousy keyboard player as well, and even worse, cellist. But singing, I'm half useful at. And yeah, that came very early. And because there were just computers in the house since I was tiny, I got very interested in them at an early age as well. So I think it's really, they've always gone hand in hand for me my whole life.
And did you think, like, I want to do this for a career, or were you sort of like, I want to play soccer and football and all that kind of stuff? Or
no,
or
you know, my ambition already... when I was a child, I actually wanted to work in radio. I wanted to be a DJ. That was actually what I really wanted to do.
That was my ambition. Classical music or rock?
I don't think I really had thought that through. I mean. We had all sorts of music playing in the house when I was growing up. My dad had a huge LP collection of, he's really into Wagner. I can't say that he's necessarily passed down his love of Wagner to me, but he would listen to The Ring Cycle, you know, practically on repeat, it felt like. And but there was plenty of other music around, but he was also into pop music as well. So I got a really broad sampling of music in the house when I was a kid. So I think I probably listened to more pop radio, but we didn't really have, there was only BBC Radio 3 in those days. I mean, obviously there's a few more classical stations in the UK these days, but there was only Radio 3. And I didn't actually have a radio in my room or anything. So it had to be sort of negotiated with other members of the family when I was little as to what we would listen to. So, and there were a lot of us. So there was plenty of debate to be had over what was going to be on the TV or the radio when I was a kid.
And so when you went to school, when you went to college, were you a music major, a tech major, or?
Yeah, it was all music for me. Yeah, so I was actually planning on doing English literature as my degree when I went to college. But it was when I was in my lower sixth at school. So that's when you're doing your A levels here in the UK before you do your university admissions. I've obviously remained very, very involved in music throughout my whole school career. I was singing in church choirs by then. I was singing in the school choirs. I was playing my cello in the orchestras, all sorts of stuff like that. But it was really my director of music at the school, who was also the organist at the church that I sang in the choir, a chap called Stephen Carlston, who was really, really, I mean, a huge influence on me. I really admired him as a musician, and he was a great leader of choirs and orchestras. Really, we tackled all sorts of stuff at school that probably we had no right really tackling. But he was always, you know, extremely clear in what he wanted, and he was really, really, as I say, an inspiring person to learn from. And he said to me in my lower sixth year that he thought, you know, do you know what? I think you would actually do okay if you applied to Oxford, which wasn't really something I was thinking about, to read a music degree at Oxford. And it just sort of, having him tell me that he thought I could do that made all the difference in the world to me. And I did apply. And I don't know if you know how the Oxbridge admission process works, but you have an exam, which is an essay exam, sort of, you know, unseen question. You just have to write some kind of essay in an hour and a half or 2 hours, whatever it was. And then if you're lucky, you go for interview. And, you know, sure enough, I was able to get interviewed. And, you know, my choice of, because my family, my older brother went to Cambridge, but nobody had been to Oxford, so I didn't know which college to pick. So again, I asked my lower sixth form tutor, who had happened to go to Oxford himself, and he recommended the college that he went to. So that was how I chose the college to apply to, literally just by, you know, talking to my religious studies teacher, who was also my form teacher. And you know, amazingly, I was admitted to the college there, and I went to Oxford to read music. And, you know, again, it was an amazing experience, because I was able to participate in all sorts of amazing performances and so on. I studied with some really brilliant lecturers. I'm sure I didn't make the most of the of the people that I was learning from, but I had an absolute whale of a time. And there wasn't much of a technology aspect to that course at all in those days. I'm sure it's very different now. We're talking about the mid-1990s here. I did do one electroacoustic paper in my finals, which was taught by Robert Sherlaw Johnson, who was a reasonably, you know, prominent composer of the of electroacoustic music. And there was one sort of garret in the music department in Oxford where they had a handful of exotic machines. There was one copy of a Sibelius 7 for Acorn lurking in a bay window somewhere. The thing that everybody wanted to get on was the Fairlight. They had a Fairlight with the huge 8-inch discs and the light pen and the screen and all the rest of it. And they had some primitive hard drive recorders on an Atari ST and so on. So I had a little bit of exposure to those sorts of things in my college life, but really my interest in technology sort of ran parallel to my work on my degree. There wasn't really much overlap. But again, you know, one of the great things about going to college in the mid-1990s is that it was the first time that you could really get exposed to, for example, the internet, because, you know, after I came home from college, we had a dial-up internet connection at home. But being in college, I had the JANET, the Joint Academic Network, which is this really, really fast internet network that connects all the UK universities to the internet. And so by 1995, I was able to, you know, explore the burgeoning web and news groups and all these amazing things. And it was, yeah, it was just a really, you know, I sort of feel very fortunate that I've kind of been around near the beginning of lots of interesting things like the home computer revolution and wider access to the internet and the web and all these things. And I was fascinated by all of it throughout. Never really thought that it was going to be where my career would take me, but I didn't actually really have a strong idea of where my career was going to take me, actually. You know, maybe I would have ended up in radio, I don't know, but I didn't, of course. But it was all sort of up for grabs when I was at college, which was a wonderful, you know, there were plenty of possibilities that felt like they were open to me when I was graduating.
It sounds like you were at the right place at the right time. If you don't mind, if I go back just a little bit,
sure.
You said you started out, you wanted to be an English major. Was that studying English writers? I assume not American writers, or?
Yeah, I mean, we did, you know, one of my favorite novels is Catch 22, which we studied when I was at school.
And say that again. I didn't hear it.
Catch 22. Joseph
Catch
Heller's
22.
Catch 22,
okay.
Yeah.
Major.
Exactly. Which, and of course, sadly, Alan Arkin just died this past weekend, as we're speaking, in the film version of Catch 22. And, so I loved that book, and we read, you know, Salinger and all sorts of other stuff. But really, the literature that really spoke to me, actually, was Thomas Hardy, both his novels and his poetry. I grew up in Dorset, which, of course, is, you know, Wessex is in all of Hardy's writing, and, you know, read Tess of the D'Urbervilles, read Jude the Obscure, which of course is about somebody going up to Oxford and all the rest of it. Read The Mayor of Casterbridge being based on Dorchester, where I lived when I was very, very small. I had a really strong affinity to the writings of Thomas Hardy. And, you know, that was probably what I would have wanted to have gone on and studied if I would have been able to then eventually choose a field of study if I had studied literature. But, you know, I let all that go, really. I mean, I still read and love those novels, and I have, you know, volumes of the poetry and so on. But that was what it was for me up until I was kind of diverted onto this other course by my director of music.
Do you think your reading and also your involvement in music, especially in singing, has played a large part in the way you develop your work with Dorico, or before when you were working with Sibelius, or it influences the decisions that you make?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure it must do, possibly in ways that I couldn't necessarily consciously say. But I do know that, for example, the fact that I was very interested in writing and in literature when I did start working at Sibelius, you know, obviously a year or two after I finished my degree, then the fact that I was semi-literate was quite useful to them, because one of the things, you know, Sibelius was a very small company in those days. I think it was probably employee number 11 or 12, something like that. And at that point, the two twin brothers who'd founded the company were still doing a lot of the, you know, really important work on obviously developing the software and doing all the marketing stuff. But also Ben, one of the two twins, Jonathan was really by that stage the main programmer. Ben was really running the business side and doing marketing. But one of the other things that he was doing was writing the documentation. And I hadn't been at the company 5 minutes, really, when Ben realized that he could probably, you know, productively put me to work on writing the documentation for the software, because I was, you know, as I say, reasonably literate and had a decent word power and could explain things clearly. And so that was pretty fateful, really, because up until that point, you know, when they hired me to work in the support team. Really, I was the third person in the support team when I joined. And what was really great about Sibelius in those early days was that, you know, everybody on staff was a musician, pretty much, working in, you know, whatever area of music was their particular sort of thing. At the time when I was hired, I was still at that stage singing as a lay clerk in the cathedral choir at Ely, which was, so I'd sort of moved across from Oxford to Cambridgeshire when I graduated, and was singing as a tenor lay clerk at Ely Cathedral.
That must be an English term. A tenor, what did you say?
Lay clerk. So a cathedral choir will typically have not only the boys on the front row, the boy mm-hmm. trebles, but they'll also have a small number of men in the back row who are paid by the cathedral. So I don't know what you would call them. Maybe you'd call them choral scholars or something in Episcopalian churches in...
As a brass player, I think we'd call him a ringer.
Oh, well, I wasn't a ringer because I was there every day.
Okay.
So I was singing in the cathedral for 8 or 9 services a week. It was 2 on Sundays, evensong on Saturday, and then evensong every day of the week except for I can't remember, I think it was Tuesdays was our day off. So, and then of course, when you get to high days and holy days, we were very, very busy, and we did tours and we did recordings and we were on Radio 3 doing even songs and so on. And that was incredible because, you know, Ely Cathedral is a beautiful building. It's been on the same spot in Ely since the 13th century. It's got this incredible octagonal tower above the nave, at the sort of at the point where the nave and the transepts and the choir meet, and it's got 16 oak trees cantilevered together that were built up there in the 13th century. Really amazing thing, built by Alan of Walsingham, and it's a beautiful cathedral. And I absolutely loved singing there. You know, we would turn up. My favourite evenings were actually sort of the cold February evenings when it was already dark by the time we were getting to the cathedral. So I'd leave Sibelius at about 4 o'clock. I'd get in my little tiny car and I'd bomb up the A10 to Ely, which was about a half hour drive. Arrive at the cathedral, always, you know, just about in time to get robed up for rehearsal. And we'd have a 20-minute rehearsal. Wouldn't even get a chance to sing all the music. It'd be cold as anything. It'd be foggy outside. It would look like, I mean, this is a terrible thing to say, but if you know what the poster for The Exorcist looks like with the streetlight and the right. and the priest standing in the streetlight with the mist and everything, that's what it looked like on my walk up to the south door of the cathedral of an evening. And then you'd be in there and you'd be in the choir, which would be the only part of the church that was illuminated. So beyond the screen up towards the altar. And there might be, you know, there'd be what? 20 boys and 6 men. There was basically one alto, one tenor, one bass on each side of the choir. And there might be 3 or 4 congregation members there. But just knowing that you were part of this tradition of this, you know, basically since Oliver Cromwell, or since they got rid of Oliver Cromwell and reopened the church in the 1500s, had basically been part of a tradition that was there at that stage for the best part of 500 years. And to be one of, you know, countless hundreds of men and boys who had sung that music in that place for those people was a really, really, you know, really, really important thing to me. And I do sort of still miss it even now. But I think that to go back to what I was saying before about why Sibelius was such a special place, is that they made time for that kind of thing. If I, you know, I was working 30 hours a week or whatever, but every day when I had to leave at 4 o'clock to get back for evensong, that was absolutely okay with everybody there. It was because that was the kind of people that they hired. They hired people who had musical interests and musical things outside of what we were doing in our day jobs. And I think that all of that was like a, you know, sort of a melange, if you like, that did very much influence me. You know, that I can really, and I think the organist at Ely as well, I mean, in a way I have him to thank for getting the job at Sibelius in the first place, because he was already using the Windows version of Sibelius, which had literally only just come out at that point when I got the job there. And they had sent an email to their users saying they were looking for people. They were looking for a marketing copywriter and they were looking for a support person. I actually applied for the marketing job, but got the support job. And I think it's because I'd been making ends meet prior to that. Because being a lay clerk it's a job where you're working for 2 hours a day, basically. So you have a lot of other time. And normally what they do, those cathedrals, is they will give you a job in the school that's connected to the cathedral where the choristers are doing their studies. But as it happened, there weren't any jobs for me. And Ely is a very small town. It's not far from Cambridge, but it's a very small town with really not a great deal going on there apart from the cathedral, the school, and otherwise it's a pretty small, sleepy village, really. It's one of the remarkable things about Ely is that, you know, that part of England is completely flat. The fens are, you know, it's the, you know, like the Netherlands, really. It's all lowlands. And you see Ely Cathedral from miles and miles around because it's basically the only thing there. And so there was a small computer shop, just a local computer shop on one of the streets in the town. And I worked there part-time for a bit. So I used to fix people's computers and so on. So I've, at that point, I sort of felt like, well, I'm combining my interests of music and technology in this life, because I'm working during the day fixing people's cheap, crappy PCs, and in the evening I'm getting to sing at a cathedral. But it was only when Paul Trepty, who was the organist at the cathedral, sent me this email from Sibelius, and he said, you know, I know you're looking for more work. Why don't you give this a try? And it felt like fate. basically. And I've never really planned anything about what I wanted to do with my life. I've been, like you say, Tony, I've kind of been in the right place at the right time, and I've had the right people just point me in the right direction at the right moment. And it's really worked out for me, and I'm incredibly grateful to have been so lucky.
Wow, that's great. It's also taking advantage of, you know, or having the skill to take advantage of being in the right place at the right time. And what you're talking about reminds me a little bit of Eddie, because being a trumpet player, Eddie has also programmed. And I think you made a certain amount of your income from programming, didn't you, at one time, Eddie?
Yeah, for a while to get through school.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was, I kind of had the same background. It's really fun to listen to you, Daniel, because I'm 45. My first computer was when I was about 4 years old.
You guys are so
young.
It was an
Atari 800. So young. Yeah, we are, Tony. It doesn't feel like it sometimes. Yeah, before the interview, we were talking about chairs, Daniel and I. Better ergonomic chairs for our backs. It's getting to that age. But yeah, kind of the same sort of background. It's like tech or music. We love both. How do we do this? And yeah, you're not interviewing me, but it's kind of fun to hear the same kind of trajectory and how you end up wedding these two interests together somehow, you know, being in the right place at the right time.
Yeah. And so you were at Sibelius, was it for 9 years? Is that correct?
Gosh, it was actually 13.
13? Oh, okay.
Yeah, so I joined there very nearly 25 years ago. I started in May of 1999, and we finished on, I think it was Halloween of 2012. So I suppose it was only 12 and a half years. Is that right? But it was a long time. And of course, because it was pretty much my first serious job after I graduated, it was, yeah, hugely formative for me. And, you know, really it was through the trust that Ben and Jonathan showed in me in the early days of working at Sibelius, you know, giving me more responsibility, getting me to write the manual. And then soon after that, sort of starting to involve me, because I was talking to customers a lot right from the very first day that I started working at Sibelius. I was talking to customers, which, you know, has its challenges, but it also has its very great rewards, because getting to interface directly with the people who are using the things that you make, and understand what they really are doing with it and what they want to do with it, what their needs are. I mean, there just simply isn't any substitute for it. You know, you can do whatever market research, focus group, whatever stuff, but what you really need is just to hear from your users. And because I was I just spent a lot of my time talking to our users. And I think that, you know, Ben and Jonathan still had many, many ideas about where they wanted to take Sibelius over, you know. So I suppose I joined when the Mac version hadn't quite come out yet. So around version 1.1, I think it was roughly when I joined. And by the time we were working on Sibelius 2, I was somewhat involved in, you know, helping them to work out what we should do. And then by the time we were working on Sibelius 3, I was primarily kind of designing the features that we agreed that we would do. And so we didn't have the proper name for it in those days, but by that stage I was basically doing product management, which is, you know, the discipline of understanding what your customers want from your product, and then working with your engineering team to figure out how to meet those requirements, and, you know, collaborating with them on the design and specification of how those requirements are going to be met, and working with the project manager to make sure that you've got the right features in the software in the right kind of time scale. And as I say, those were things that, you know, we didn't really, I think product management certainly would have existed as a discipline, but in a small company like Sibelius, where everybody just kind of was a, you know, jack of all trades and master of none, really. You know, you were moved around working on different things at different times. We didn't know what to call it, but that's what it was. And I was basically apprenticed in product management and marketing, in fact, by Ben and Jonathan. And, you know, again, if they hadn't put that sort of faith in me at that early stage, I certainly wouldn't be doing what I'm doing now, but I probably wouldn't even have been able to do what I subsequently did after they sold the company, after I'd been there for about 7 years. And basically at that point, you know, whereas up until then we'd been collaborating on every version, at that point it's sort of the responsibility then became sort of more or less mine alone at that point to work with the development team and figure out what we would do and how. And it was, you know, that was only possible because they had really taken me under their wing and mentored me through those early years. And again, you know, right place, right time. But as you say, hopefully able to take advantage of the opportunity when it came.
Right. Let me ask you a hypothetical question and see what you think about this, because I think it may pertain and may not pertain to what we're talking about. I think back to the invention of the automobile, and people were saying, that's ridiculous. You know, people have ridden horses for many, many years. And the idea of just, I forget who said it, but like build a better horse, you know. And Henry Ford said, no, we're going to, or I think maybe Steve Jobs was sort of this idea too. We're going to go further than what people think we can do, and we're going to show them what's possible. Is it sort of a combination of those two things? Like when you're working in product development, of here's something that people will not have thought of, and we're going to try and do that, combined with here's what people want.
That's a great way of putting it. You're right. I think the saying about the automobile is, if you'd asked them what they wanted, they just would have said they wanted faster horses, right?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's exactly right. And certainly, one of the things that I will often say to customers when I talk to them is, I don't want to know what you think the solution is. And again, this is not sort of some big headed thing like, oh, I'm the clever person who can come up with a solution for any problem. But really, it's that when a customer is able to explain to you their problem, then that's when you can, you know, using the knowledge that you've got about how things work already, what other things you might be interesting to work on. If somebody tells you a solution, but you can't really get to the bottom of what the real underlying requirement is, you know, why do they want this particular thing they tell you they want, then you're never really going to be able to go beyond just building a faster horse, if we put it that way. It's really being able to understand the underlying user need. And also, I think being able to predict user need as well, which is of course difficult, because any kind of predicting of the future is a bit of a mug's game. But we have to use the, you know, the experience that we gain from talking to customers, our knowledge of the wider industry that we're part of and observing and, you know, shaping to some degree, but also reacting at the same time. Obviously the broader technology world is moving on apace all the time. So you're sort of trying to put all of that into a big mixing pot and give it a good stir and hope that what comes out of it is something that, yeah, I mean, the best possible reaction I could get to something that we release, for example, would be surprise and delight, basically. That, you know, here's something that I didn't know I wanted, but I'm absolutely thrilled to have it. And it's rare when you come up with those things, but it is incredibly gratifying when you do. But, you know, most of the time we have to settle for, the user has given us a clear problem statement. How do we elegantly solve that requirement in a way that is, you know, chimes well with the rest of the application, doesn't make anything else more complicated? You know, there's endless trade-offs to be made. But I do think that, again, just sort of about being in the right place at the right time. If you think back to what Ben and Jonathan were doing when they started on Sibelius, you know, and I was able to go and see Ben recently. He was doing a talk in London because it was actually the 30th anniversary of the first version of Sibelius for Acorn, so the Acorn computers, I don't know how many of your listeners will be familiar with them, but Acorn was a UK computer manufacturer. They got big in the 1980s because the BBC did this in conjunction with the government. They did a computer literacy program that was a huge part of the 1980s. It's what got computers into schools in the UK. It's what got a lot of people having computers into their homes as well in the UK. And Acorn was the manufacturer that was selected to provide the computer that would be part of the BBC's literacy program. And that was the computer that Ben and Jonathan had at home. And the way that they approached writing the first version of Sibelius was to write it in assembler language, which is basically when you're coding directly to the hardware of the machine. You're not using a high-level language. And so that meant that they were able to do exactly what they wanted to do. They didn't have to conform to any kind of conventions that were in you know, the way the operating system worked, for example. They could literally bypass all of that if they wanted to. And so that's why Sibelius for Acorn was such a revolutionary product, basically, because it was a WYSIWYG music publishing program at a time when, for example, Finale on the Apple Mac was not really WYSIWYG. Screen resolution was very slow. You know, update was very slow. Resolution was very low. You had to press Command L the entire time to get the window to update to show you how the music really looked and so on. And yet, because they were able to kind of not build a faster horse, but instead go to the way that the computer made it. You know, so this was a particularly powerful computer, the Acorn Archimedes, that was the successor to the computer that we'd all had in schools as kids, because it was where, for example, the ARM processors that are now in every mobile phone, in every television set-top box, and every embedded system basically uses the technology that was invented by the Acorn team, by the advanced research group at Acorn, and then that got spun off into ARM later on. But what it meant was that this computer that they had access to in the early 1990s was so much more powerful than the average PC or Apple Mac that people were using in the wider world, that they were able to build a piece of software that was fundamentally different in design to the other software that was around. And so what was really interesting was then, as they then had to migrate it onto those platforms where people did have expectations about how software should work, because Windows applications work a certain way, Apple Macintosh applications work a certain way, they were able to keep the bits that made Sibelius 7 for Acorn so unique, and then translate them into this new, you know, sort of more slightly more restricted world. And again, that was a great lesson, to see how they decided to keep the essence of what was unique, but how to then moderate it into a framework that was more conventional. And I really, yeah, I say there are so many lessons that I learned in those early years that I've continued to kind of be able to draw upon in my later career. And just the notion that you could do something that was so completely sort of, if you like, from left field in terms of what people expected computers to be able to do, and then what Ben and Jonathan were able to make it do, it's like, yeah, always push for more, always try to go the extra mile if you can.
A personal story about surprise and delight for me just recently. So when you're engraving, you can enter the instruments into the score, and I just started on an opera about Leon Theremin, the inventor of the theremin, who also, spoiler alert, was a Russian spy, that most people don't realize that. Had a very, very interesting life and was a genius. And so I was thinking, well, what am I going to enter for a theremin? Because, you know, there's no theremin certainly on an engraving system. And then all of a sudden I looked in Dorico and there's a theremin there that sounds like a theremin. So on the playback. So that was my surprise and delight moment. Eddie, I think you have a question.
It's just a nerdy question. Not the machine language, the assembly language. How long did that take them? Because to me, that is genius. And I know that's how they did it back in the day. Like when I was doing Atari stuff, you had to do assembly language to get anything to happen. So how long did it take?
It took them a while. And what was really cool is that they not only did it all in assembler, but they also came up with a special... I'm sorry, this is really nerdy as well. I apologize, Tony. And half of your listeners won't care about this. But they also came up with a special preprocessor language where they could basically... effectively write the source code in something that was a bit more like natural language. Because as you know, with assembler, it's all just basically those very short opcodes that correspond to the instructions on the processor.
Right,
but what
they
did was they wrote something that was effectively a preprocessor language that would then convert into assembler. So they could actually write in this sort of pseudo assembler, but it was more like a sort of a high level language, and then they ran that source code through the preprocessor, which then spat out the actual
Acorn
assembler. And they have that printed. Jonathan has two volumes. I think he actually submitted it for his DPhil or his PhD of that preprocessor language of the original Sibelius 7 source code, and it's super cool. I actually only saw that. That blimmin' book was on the shelf in the office for many, many years, and I never really took it down and looked at it. It was only when Ben actually explained at that talk that I was at just a few months ago just how clever that was. What a stroke of genius it is to come up with the idea of using a preprocessor that would allow you to avoid having to remember all of the, you know, so they could even do high-level things where it would actually be a number of instructions that would be chained together, but they had a single preprocessor instruction for it. Really, really clever. And, you know, again, that sort of incredible left-field thinking that they brought to everything that they've done. I mean, they really are remarkable men, Ben and Jonathan Finn.
Yeah,
that's
beautiful. That's amazing.
So you were, the first 7 years, they were there, and then they left, and then you had another, five, 6 years... something like that. And then Avid took over, and I don't know if you want to talk about this or not, but then all of a sudden you guys were out of a job. You and your team were out of a job, and there was quite a bit of to put it mildly, controversy about that. And also a person who really backed you and was trying to find out what was happening was named Derek Williams. He had some things on YouTube and trying to find out what was going on. And so I'm wondering, did they, the new people at David, did they call you in or did they just send an email or how did that go about, if you want to talk about it?
Yeah, I can talk about it. I mean, it's a long time ago now. So we were, the company's called Avid rather than Avid, but that doesn't
matter. Avid, okay.
That's okay. So yeah, they bought Sibelius in 2006. So that's when Ben and Jonathan, they basically felt that they couldn't really continue to grow the company in the way that it needed to develop with the resources of just being, you know, effectively a family run company. They had taken a little bit of venture capital money a few years earlier. And of course, once you take venture capital money, there's always a little bit of pressure to have an exit. And I think also by the stage that they actually sold Sibelius, they'd been working on it for very nearly 20 years. So they started working on it when they were schoolboys in the late 1980s. And it wasn't until 1993 that they incorporated the company and started actually selling the software. But, you know, by the time 2006 rolled around, as I say, it was very nearly 20 years of their lives. And they were looking for a company that could really take it onto the next level. And at the time, although, you know, we say that it was Avid that bought Sibelius, actually at the time it was a company called DigiDesign. So Avid was at the time a kind of loosely conglomerated bunch of companies. It had grown through acquisition. Avid was made famous in the early 1990s because I think it's true to say, basically, Avid invented non-linear video editing on the computer. So the Avid, as it was known, although really it's never been called the Avid, that was always the company name, but it became known as the Avid, and in Hollywood is still known as the Avid, was the first kind of offline video editing software that used hard drive, you know, around the same time or maybe just a little bit ahead of when we were starting to use hard drives for audio recording and samplers and so on. The same thing was happening with video, and it was really Avid that pioneered that. And so they became massive as a result of this. You know, they exploded in size in the 1990s, and they acquired DigiDesign sometime later in the 1990s, and DigiDesign were the makers of Pro Tools, which is still the industry standard recording software today, you know, 30 years on, basically. And DigiDesign were interested in acquiring Sibelius because DigiDesign wanted to push into education, where Sibelius had always been very strong. DigiDesign also wanted to have more notation expertise. So Pro Tools didn't have any notation features in it at all. You could do MIDI work in it, and you could do audio work in it, but you couldn't do any scoring work in it. And because it was often used in Hollywood films and things like this, they thought that it would be a good idea to have notation. And so that was one of the things that they wanted to leverage by buying Sibelius. But the trouble was that it was 2006, and not long after that, the financial crisis happened, the 2008 financial crisis, when all the mortgages went to heck in a handbasket and things got quite bad. And Avid basically found itself at that time not having really integrated all these businesses that it had acquired. It had acquired another video editing firm called Pinnacle. There was M Audio, which makes consumer grade electronic stuff. All sorts of companies have been kind of brought under the Avid umbrella, but they weren't really integrated. And so there's a lot of redundancy in the business. And so even though the company's turnover was, you know, $800 million a year or something, really very significant, they weren't particularly profitable at that time. And then when the financial crisis came along, that really put a new level of pressure. And so there was a lot of management change at the top of the company at that time. And pretty soon, everybody who had been involved in the decision to acquire Sibelius was no longer working at Avid or DigiDesign. And there was then this move to have the so-called One Avid move, when all of these individual brands went away and everything was unified together under the main Avid brand. And there was a lot of internal turmoil during that time. And, you know, when Avid acquired Sibelius in 2006, I think we had nearly 80 employees. So there was a big office in London where we'd all come together in the early 2000s. There was an office in Adelaide in Australia. We had an office in Walnut Creek in San Francisco. We had a small office in Tokyo. And over time, gradually, as Avid kind of was trying to make itself profitable again, they basically laid off huge numbers of my colleagues, you know, my wife, who I'd met through work, she lost her job. You know, gradually everybody lost their job, basically. And so it was finally in 2012, the only people who were left from the original Sibelius company by that stage were the development team. So me and Ben Timms, who was the head of the scoring team at that time, and the programmers and our testers. And yeah, eventually they decided that they even really wanted to get rid of the programmers and the testers on the grounds that at the time they believed that it was possible, and maybe they still believe this, I don't know, but at the time they thought that effectively software engineering was a very transferable skill, which of course it is. You know, software developers can work on all sorts of projects, but a project like Sibelius is pretty unusual and pretty special, I would say. There's not many people out there who would have the particular combination of domain expertise in terms of deep musical knowledge, deep knowledge of music engraving, composition, orchestration, all these sorts of skills, and the ability to write, you know, code to a very high level. But the company, I think, judged that it was possible to find in the company's offshore departments, that basically they'd subcontracted a load of development work to Ukraine at the time, to a company called Global Logic. And so the plan was that they would basically, as they closed down the last remaining office in the UK, they would also get rid of all the developers and the testers and hire people in Kiev who would then be able to take on the development of the program from there. And as you say, it was pretty controversial. I think that the one of the things that the new management team at Avid didn't really understand until maybe it was a little bit too late was that Sibelius was a little bit unusual amongst the brands that Avid had under its umbrella, in that there was a very direct relationship between many of the company's customers and many of the people who worked on the product. You know, not only me, who people knew quite well by that stage, having been there for, you know, 12, 13 years. And certainly since Ben and Jonathan had sold the company, was sort of that if you knew anybody who online who was to do with Sibelius, chances are it was me, although it might have been one of my colleagues. And so, yeah, when the news got out that we were being let go, it really set off quite a lot of controversy, as you say, Tony, because people felt like they were risking not only losing the product that they had grown to love, but also the people who had built the product. And I do sometimes think that the users of the product understood better than the company did that that a big part of Sibelius, and I think really any significant software product, is not just the source code, but it's the brains, you know, the other half of the source code for any application. You know, you can build the source code with any computer, no problem. But if you want to change the source code, then you're missing the other 50% of it, which lives in the heads of the people who dreamed it up. And I think that, you know, obviously on one level, they understand that, you know, this is a big company with, at the time, I think we left something like 1,500 employees. It was not like they had no idea what they were doing, but I think they made a misjudgment in the case of the Sibelius team and the Sibelius product, in that they didn't realize that the users would figure out what was happening. They, I think, underestimated the difficulty they would have in finding people who were able to take on the project and work on it. And Sibelius's development slowed down for quite a few years. I mean, it's in a good place now. They have successfully rebuilt the team, but it slowed them down for many years, and of course, inadvertently created a competitor for them in the process.
One thing that really impressed me with this video that Derek Williams did was he said something about a real lack of consideration for the users, the way they did it. And that's what impresses me so much about Dorico. So for me, one thing that's will be very interesting to learn is, how did you start Dorico, and how did you make that work financially? So you have a job, and then all of a sudden you don't have a job. You're going to start a company, and I'm not sure how long it took you before you got this product to market, but at least, what, a year or two, a couple of years. How did you navigate that?
We were incredibly fortunate, as we have been. You know, so we were very unfortunate, of course, to be in the situation where we were losing our jobs at the time. And certainly, you know, I can't speak for all of my colleagues, but for me, that summer of 2012, they came to us you asked Tony, how did it happen? And the day that we found out, we it was our custom as a team to have a daily stand-up meeting. And a stand-up meeting is one where literally you stand. And so that keeps the meeting short because nobody wants to be standing up for hours while you're talking. So the idea is you get all the developers and testers together in a circle. We used to meet. We had the office was this weird, it was an old warehouse, basically, that we were working in. And the acoustics of it were actually really bad for holding a conversation if you stood out in the main part of the office. So there was a mezzanine above the front door. So we used to stand under the mezzanine where there was less acoustic sort of echo, and so that was where we would have our meeting every day. And so we were doing our meeting at 10 o'clock in the morning, as we always did, as was our custom. And then there was a knock at the door, and it was the head of HR for the whole of Avid, who had flown over on the red eye from Boston and was arriving, had just arrived at Heathrow and come straight to our office. And literally, we were in the middle of our daily stand-up meeting. We had no idea anything was happening. And then we were taken up to the meeting room and basically told by the head of HR, you know, how much they'd appreciated what we'd done for them, that they appreciated that we were, you know, a very close-knit team and really like a family in some ways, which is true. You know, we'd all been very carefully chosen and hired by Ben and Jonathan and by Alison and Jeremy, the people, the managers they put in place to run the company. And, you know, we'd all been there for a long time by that stage, you know, and many of us started as recent graduates and had got married and had children and, you know, sort of really were very, very close-knit group of people. And yeah, we just found out by them turning up on I think it was a Tuesday morning in July, this time of year, actually, as we're speaking. And they just told us just like that. And then, of course, that begins the HR process and so on. But what was amazing was that I don't know how it got out so quickly, but it did get out almost within days. And even while we were still sort of working through the HR process, we knew that there were other companies out there who were interested in talking to us. And so once we left Avid, finally, Steinberg, which is the company we work for now, reached out to us and basically offered to hire as many of us as were still available. A few members of the team had already taken other employment, you know, so I was one of the last few. There were 15 of us there in the July, and by the October it was down to six, and there was a handful of us that were kept just to do handover tasks and so on. So some of my colleagues who'd left earlier in the summer had already taken other jobs, but Steinberg basically offered to anybody who was part of the team who wanted to go and work for Steinberg that they would set up a new... So Steinberg is a German company. It's founded in 1984 by Charlie Steinberg. Steinberg really, again, like Avid, you know, they innovated the video editing software. Steinberg really innovated sequences. They pretty much invented it in the mid-1980s with Pro 16 and Pro 24 on first the Commodore 64 and then the Atari ST, and then eventually that became Cubase on the Atari ST and then on Mac and then on Windows. And by the time that we were joining them in 2012, so the company was nearly 30 years old, it had been acquired by Yamaha in 2004. Funnily enough, prior to being acquired by Yamaha, it had actually been owned by the American video company Pinnacle. And when Avid acquired Pinnacle, Pinnacle sold Steinberg to Yamaha. So there's even an Avid connection in Steinberg's history as well.
In part two, Daniel talks about his beginnings with Steinberg and the excitement and fear of developing a new product from the ground up in an already competitive market. He talks about coming up with something innovative and not just, as he says, building a faster horse. He also walks Tony through what a day in the life as a product marketing manager looks like. If you're enjoying these conversations, please share the podcast with anybody you know that loves all things music.